Good afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time, as usual. Right now, our lines are wide open. There's no one waiting, so if you'd like to give me a call, if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith, you can reach me at 1-800-438-5090. Well, there's some calls coming in now, but you can still reach me. There's a couple lines open. 1-800-438-5090. And I want to tell our local Santa Cruz area listeners that on Thursday nights, when I'm in the area, I have a meeting in a home, and it's an open Bible discussion meeting. It's an enjoyable time held by a group of people who are listeners to the program. And if you're interested in fellowshipping with us, I am in town this week, and that's this Thursday at 7 o'clock. If you want information about that meeting, you can go to the website, thenarrowpath.com. And there you will click on the link that says Announcements. You can then find information about how to join us this Thursday night at 7 o'clock. If you'd like to be on the program right now, the number is 1-800-438-5090. Our first caller is Michelle from Smithton, Illinois. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve.
Good to hear from you again.
Yeah. I have actually a couple of situations that I need insight on. I'll try to explain one, and then it'll kind of lead into the other. I have a brother who has left his wife and four kids after 14 and a half years and has met another woman, even though he says that he wanted to leave his wife long before she came into the picture. I have spoke with him briefly and expressed our concern and disagreement for how he's going about these things as kindly as we could. He did ask, I guess, what our feelings were about meeting her and bringing her around, and we were very uncomfortable with that and kind of told him of our objection for that. We have four kids that we don't really feel should be, I guess, right, put into that situation. Since then, he has actually introduced his own four children to the girlfriend. They are not, nothing's been signed. The divorce is not final. So in our mind, there was still hope that, you know, if we can direct his path that, you know, he can turn around, they can reconcile. So I guess our question is, how do you handle or how do you treat a blood relative who has done the things that he has and who isn't really a believer? I guess, how do you what path do we take? How, you know,
he's not a professing Christian.
I'm sorry?
He's not a professing Christian?
No, he will say that, you know, what he knows that what he's doing is not right. He'll make comments like that, but he's continuing down that path.
Yeah. I would just tell him that one of the things that you look for most in people that you associate with is integrity. It's never very safe to hang out with people who betray people, because they might betray you. And when a person has made a vow to his wife, and on the strength of that vow, she has given up her life to become his wife and have his children and things like that, and his vow has included the promise that he will stay with her no matter what happens, for better or for worse, in sickness and health and so forth. Now, when he has just thrown his integrity to the wind and betrayed the person to whom he owes the most in the world, I would tell him that I have great difficulty wanting to associate with somebody who would betray their best friend and the person to whom they're most indebted, because a person who would do that is a betrayer. A person who does that does not care about their integrity. They care about something else more. Obviously, he cares more about his hormones or something. But if a person cares more about his hormones than his integrity, he's an evil man. He may seem like a nice guy, but anyone who will chase skirts instead of keep promises to his children and his troops and his mother is, I mean, there's not a nice way to put it. He's an evil man. I'm sorry to say that, because I think you said he's your brother.
Yes, he is.
And I don't know if you have to say it quite so bluntly to him. He might not receive it if you said it that way. He's not professing to be a Christian, so it's not as if you have to excommunicate him. In other words, it's not that you can't ever associate with him at family gatherings or whatever. But I think you need to make it very clear to him that you're on the side of his wife and his children, and that he is their enemy, and that anyone who has become an enemy of your sister-in-law and your nieces and nephews cannot be considered really someone that you would count a friend.
Okay. Yeah, that's kind of our perspective, although, the second portion of the situation has drawn up that I have a second brother who is a Christian,
uh-huh.
who is very close to him and who does not agree. Also, he does not agree or approve of what he's doing, but yet he feels as though he needs to try to be there for him. He has made comments that said, well, the attitude, I guess, is, well, everyone sins and no one's perfect and we still have to love them. And, I think part of his is just fear for him losing
yeah.
his brother. I mean,
well, if you're,
it is very difficult.
Yeah.
And along with that, another difficult situation has come up where he also wants to spend time, him and his new girlfriend spend time with his family and his children. And that has brought up a conflict within my younger brother's marriage because his wife is in disagreement with subjecting her own, their own children
yes.
to the same situation I feel strongly about.
Right.
So now he's basically, in the position where, well, I'm the head and this is, what we're doing and I'm not going to abandon him and throw him to the trash. And
well, Michelle, let me jump in here. Let me jump in here if I could. I think your brother, the younger brother, actually is within his rights to maintain contact with the other brother. I don't think he's within his rights to steamroll over his wife's objections about family associated with him. I mean, the mother's concern for her children is as valid as the father's concern for his children. And I think that your younger brother should say to his brother, to your brother, my wife and children will not be associating with us because your younger brother probably won't say this because he probably isn't blunt spoken. He may not even have strong convictions. I don't know if he does or not. But what someone needs to say to the brother who's left his wife is, you've stabbed somebody in the back who was loyal to you. And I don't want to subject my children and my wife and my, my family to a situation where they become emotionally vulnerable to somebody who stabs people in the back. When you left your wife and children, you stabbed them in the back. You had promised them faithfulness, and you just lied. You just betrayed them. You just turned into a Judas. And, I think your younger brother can say, God still loves you enough that he'll have you back if you repent. And I, as a Christian, I love you too. But obviously, if let's take the situation a little different. Suppose what your brother had done was not that he left his wife. Let's suppose he kept her chained up in a basement and tortured her every day. Would any of the family members say, well, I'd like my kids to get to know this guy? I don't think so.
No.
And yet, to commit adultery is the most horrendous, it is the most cruel, nonviolent act one person can commit against another. And your brother is doing that to his wife. She's tortured every day by him. And she, as far as I know, she's done nothing to deserve it. And every day that he stays with this other woman, he's torturing his wife and his children. Now, why would anyone want their families to have any association with someone who's doing that?
Exactly. Well, that's where Sean and I both are in agreement with that. It's just hard when we have, my Christian brother who, I guess,
right.
thought counsel that says, we have to love them. And our thought is, well, let's, how do you love, and I guess.
Does he believe in disciplining his children?
Oh, yeah. Yes, he does.
Does he think that's unloving?
No, he wouldn't say that. But the remark is, well, it's different. That's a different. This is a different situation.
Well, it is different, but it's not different in principle. In principle, it is not unloving to stand up to someone who's committing a crime against family members. And by the way, your nieces and nephews are family members.
Yes.
Just as much as your brother is. They are blood relatives of yours, and he has become their enemy. You know, when a man leaves his wife, or when a woman leaves her husband and children, the statistics show they put their children into a much higher risk category for suicide, for drug abuse, for promiscuity, for crime. I mean, the statistics have been gathered. It's obvious that when children are children of divorce, they are in a much higher risk category. Now, any man or woman that would willingly, because he's got his hormones firing off, would put his children in that kind of danger, is a fool and an evil monster. Now, of course, our society doesn't think that way. Our society says, well, he's entitled to his happiness. Well, so is Adolf Hitler, I suppose. And if it makes Adolf Hitler happy to put people in ovens, then I guess he's entitled to it. But I don't think so. I don't think so, and I don't think anyone who's got any common sense thinks so. And I really think that for your brother, your younger brother, to say, you know, what you're doing is absolutely offensive to everyone in the family. And therefore, my wife and children don't want to be around you, and I don't blame them. But I'm your brother, and I love you, and I would like to do what I can to help restore you to a place where you're not damaging the people nearest to you and the people who you owe the most to.
Right. He feels that if he speaks up, which is part of the problem, it's like if you're there and you want to be the light and to guide him and help rebuke, you know, in that instance, great. But at the same time, I think he just leaves it. He doesn't address it. He just says, well, you need to get your stuff together. You know, says it real plainly to where there's really no call to action.
Your sister-in-law, who's been abandoned in this case, and her four children, they are family. They are your family. She became one with him when she married him, so she's like a blood relative of yours, and her children are blood relatives of yours. And he is tormenting, torturing, betraying them. He is their enemy. He has made himself their enemy. And I it's just got to be put that plainly. That's just the way it is. He has become the enemy of his wife and children. And they are your nephews, nieces, and sister-in-law. And you cannot befriend, and no one should expect you to befriend somebody who is the enemy trying to destroy the lives of people who are your family.
How would you handle the marriage situation of my younger brother who, you know, you said, you wouldn't have him steamroll over her, but
right.
Her being, you know, the wife and submitting to the leading of the husband, I guess, is it our place to kind of guide him and to
I think you should
come to a different conclusion and try to maybe seek out.
I think you should point out to him that he had better think very, very hard and pray very, very long before forcing his wife and children to do something that they have a conscience against. I don't think a wife has to obey her husband if she's got a godly conscience and he's telling her to do something sinful. And she has a conscience against associating with this man who's, I mean, if he'll do this to his children, what might he do to his nephews and nieces? What might he do to other people? Now, of course, someone's going to say, oh, now, Steve, you're going overboard here. Lots of people divorce their wives and leave their children, and they never hurt another fly. Well, I can't figure how that would be. Why would you hurt the person you love the most and yet expect to be trusted around people that you don't love as much? Our society has gone crazy. And unfortunately, your brother, who's left his wife, has succumbed to the craziness of our age. Now, your younger brother doesn't need to. And what I would have Sean talk to your younger brother, you and Sean together probably, talk to him and say, you know, if you want to associate with brother so-and-so, you certainly have every right to do so. But your wife feels strongly against this, and we feel too that you should reach out to your brother without dragging vulnerable other parties into it who don't feel comfortable there. Now, if your younger brother doesn't know that that's sensible, then he's, I'm afraid, a very foolish husband. And I don't want to say that about him because I don't know him, but I hope he won't make such a foolish decision.
Right. The point that I had said was pretty much exactly like you had said. You know, if she's trying to stand in protection of her children and she does not agree with this, it's kind of like, you know, going against the grain with that. And then, you know, his reply was that, well, I don't feel convicted that I'm doing anything wrong, so why wouldn't I, you know, do what I'm doing, which is just basically being there.
Well, his wife has a conscience, too.
Right.
You know, I mean, his conscience isn't the only one that matters. His conscience isn't the only one that matters.
Uh-huh.
You know, his wife's conscience is as valuable as his.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can have him listen to this conversation if you want. It's online.
Yes, I plan on doing that.
Okay.
With you.
And he can call me if he disagrees.
Okay, yeah. I've said that many times. I'm like, well, you know, don't just take our word for it, you know. Seek someone who has, you know, a lot of insight into this. So I guess our stumbling thing was when he sought other people who said, well, you still have to love them. But our thought was, well, show me, you know, what that love's going to look like.
Yeah.
Is it just
to
welcome him in?
Do you have to love him in a way that's
okay,
not loving to everybody else?
Exactly. Exactly.
Don't you have to love the innocent people, too?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you only have to judge. You only have to love guilty people. You don't have to love innocent people. I mean, this is not clear thinking. Of course, the body of Christ is very much lacking in clear thinking on many subjects, as is obvious. But this is certainly foggy thinking on their part. You got to love him. Sure, you got to love him, and you got to love his victims, and you got to stand up for his victims. You got to stand on the side of his victims. You can love him, but you got to love him like you love a criminal who's a dangerous character who's hurting the people in your family. That's what he is.
I think that's the hard part. He's not able to get past the fear of what he's doing and that it'll lead him away, you know.
Yeah, we need to be not cowards. I mean, sometimes doing the right thing alienates us from people we really want to be friends with, and we want their love. We don't want them to reject us, and so we become wimps, and we don't stand up for what we know is right. And in the process, we end up betraying people that we should be standing with.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, Michelle. I'm so very sorry to hear about this situation.
Yes, it is. It is very saddening, but you just reassured us that, you know, okay, it's we're doing okay, that we don't have to choose to be a part of being around the situation. And in a sense, in my mind, it was always like, okay, we were going to be welcoming her as a part of the family when we didn't agree.
So she's his whore.
Right.
Okay. You don't need to bring people like that into your home.
Okay. Well,
okay.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks, Michelle.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Well, sometime ask me what I really think about the situation when I'm not guarding my speech so much. Let's talk to Sue from Everett, Washington next. Hi, Sue. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I was reading in my one-year Bible this morning, and I wasn't paying attention to the even the book. Or I remember it was chapter 16 in the Old Testament. The spirit left Saul, and the Lord sent an evil spirit to him, or in another version, it was a distressing spirit.
Yeah.
And that perplexed me, so I would like to have some understanding about that, because that was I've never read the Bible all the way through, so I'm attempting to do that now. And I had no concept, no idea, that the Lord sent evil or distressing spirits to us. I was told,
yeah,
I've been taught that that's not true. Can you help
well,
me with that?
I can try. First of all, it's the New King James that uses the word distressing spirits. And although I use the New King James and think it's a good version, I'm not pleased that they've changed the expression from evil spirit to distressing spirit. Because in the Hebrew, it is, well, let's put it this way, in the Greek Old Testament, the Septuagint, it is the same word that the New Testament uses for evil spirits. And so the King James Version always used the term evil spirit, but the New King James, they thought it was a little bit difficult for people to swallow that God would send an evil spirit, so they changed it to a distressing spirit. And what this was, a demonic spirit. Now, God sent it? That doesn't sound right. Well, the worldview that the Bible teaches is that God is sovereign over everything he has made. That would include over the evil spirits. Now, that doesn't mean that they are friendly with him. That doesn't mean that he's friendly with them. It just means that he's in control of everything, and they can't do anything if he doesn't give them free rein, because he could fence them in. He can bind them. He can do whatever he wants to. So whatever the spirits do, they do, we have to say, at least with God's permission. And when in the Old Testament, we see, for example, in the book of Job, that that the devil comes to God and tries to get permission to afflict Job. Well, he gets permission, but God restricts how much freedom the devil has there. He says, you can do this much, but you can do no more. And then the devil leaves the presence of the Lord and goes and afflicts Job. So one could say that the devil came from the Lord and afflicted Job, because the devil had to first go to the Lord and get permission. Now, in the Old Testament, there's another interesting story of a similar type to the one you're bringing up, and that's over in 1 Kings chapter 22, where an evil king, Ahab, the one who married Jezebel, he was slated for destruction. God was going to wipe him out, and he's going to die in battle. And he's checking with the prophets that are in his employment to see if it's safe for him to go to battle. And all the prophets are giving him the thumbs up on that, because they're all false prophets. But then there's a real prophet from God named Micaiah, and he comes and he says, no, you're going to die. He basically says, you're going to die in battle. He says, I saw Israel like sheep scattered with no shepherd, and that means the king was dead. And then the prophet said to King Ahab this. He says, I saw the Lord sitting in heaven. He saw a vision. I saw the Lord and all the angels, all the spirits were around him. And he was saying, the Lord was saying, who will go and persuade Ahab to die at Ramoth-Gilead? And one suggestion was made by one spirit and another by another. And finally he says, a spirit came forth and said, I will persuade him. And God said, how? And this spirit said, I will be a lying spirit in the mouth of his prophets. And the Lord said, go and do so. And so the prophet said, therefore, Ahab, just know this, God has sent a lying spirit into the mouth of your false prophets to get you to go and die at Ramoth-Gilead, because they're encouraging you to go. Well, Ahab didn't listen to Micaiah, and Ahab went to battle and died in battle. But you see, that's an interesting story, because this prophet had a vision into heaven and saw what was going on behind the scenes. There was an evil spirit, a lying spirit, sent from God to the mouth of these prophets to bring judgment on Ahab. But the spirit came forward and made the suggestion, and it was subject to God's veto or to God's approval. And God said, okay, do it. And so the spirit came from God. But it was not necessarily a spirit that was, you know, friendly to God. The Bible makes it very clear that the evil spirits are not friendly to God, but they really are very limited in what they can do. They're limited to what he permits. So on the occasion you're reading about, God determined to judge Saul. And so an evil spirit from the Lord came to Saul. Well, we have to kind of read between the lines and say that evil spirit had presented itself to the Lord asking permission to afflict Saul. And God said, okay, go.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That clears it up for me. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Okay, Sue. Hey, thanks for your call.
Thank you very much.
God bless you.
God bless you as well. Bye.
Bye now. Okay, Seth from Las Vegas is next. Welcome to The Narrow Path, Seth.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm going to ask you a question, and then I'm going to hang up and listen to your response.
All right.
In the Bible there, it says that a wicked man borrows and doesn't repay.
Yes.
And then I've also read in the Old Testament about the Jewish people had this thing called the Jubilee, to where, mm-hmm. like every 7 years or something, their debt would get wiped out and forgiven, and they could have a fresh start.
That's right.
Now, I just want to know how God looks at believers, Christians, who, let's say, get in trouble with a business and they're just in debt, and if they file a bankruptcy or something, I just want to know how God would look at that as a believer, because I got two conflicting, you know, like where it says the wicked man borrows and doesn't repay, but then in, right. They had the Jubilee where debt would get wiped out. So I'm going to go ahead and hang up and listen to your response, and I want to thank you for your show and what you're doing.
Okay, Seth. Thanks. Well, I know a lot of people today are in that circumstance where they've got debt and they're maybe unemployed and the economy's bad and they're not sure what to do and they're wondering if they should file bankruptcy. Let me just say that the Jubilee in the Jewish law does not apply to debts that we enter into for this reason. In the Jewish society, everyone who lent money did so knowing very well that debt would be canceled at the Jubilee. Now, of course, the Jubilee happened every 50 years. So if someone was lending money, they might say, well, it's 30 years from now till the Jubilee, or 3 years from now to the Jubilee, depending. And if the person, you know, lent at that time, they knew that debt was going to be canceled at that time. And they would not lend if they weren't willing to lend on those terms. They hoped probably to be repaid. Or maybe they had compassion on the poor and just realized, well, this debt's going to be canceled. Anyways, that's okay. I don't mind helping these people out. In any case, the debts that were contracted in Israel were contracted in full view of this Jubilee year. And therefore, the ones doing the lending were doing so with the subtext that, well, of course, if Jubilee comes, you don't have to pay me back. Now, modern lenders don't do that. Modern lenders do not lend you money thinking, well, you know, if such and such year comes, you're just free from this debt. And so when we borrow money today, if we do, and I don't recommend it, but if you borrow money today, you're borrowing from someone who expects to be paid back, and you're promising to pay back. Now, obviously, sometimes you'll make a promise to pay someone back, and then circumstances will change, and you won't be able to see how you could possibly do that, how you could possibly pay them back. You don't have any money and no job. I would say, first of all, and there's no sense saying shame, because it's too late. But for those who are not in debt, let me just say that's a good reason not to go into debt, since you don't know if you're going to be able to pay it back. You don't know if the economy is going to go down the tubes. You don't know if you're going to have a job. Live within your means and don't borrow money. That's the first thing I'd suggest. But for those who've already done so, there's no sense crying over spilled milk. You've got debts, and as a Christian, it should be your desire to pay off those debts completely, or at least in whatever measure the lender will agree to. You can sometimes go back, of course, and renegotiate a payoff for a lesser amount, because sometimes they'd rather get a small amount than nothing, and if the lender agrees to a settlement that is something that's actually something you can do, then it's not immoral for you to do that. It's not immoral for you to take what they agree to, because of course they're not required to agree to it. So if they do it, they do it voluntarily. In the book of Proverbs, it says very strongly that we should, if we lend, we have gotten into trouble. In Proverbs 6:1, it says, "My son, if you become surety to your friend, if you've shaken hands and pledged for a stranger." Now, this is surety, not debt, but it's the same principle. The idea is you've made a commitment, and you've got a financial obligation now. It says, "You are snared by the words of your own mouth. You're taken by the words of your mouth. So do this, my son, and deliver yourself. For you have come into the hand of your friend. Go humble yourself. Plead with your friend. Give no sleep to your eyes, nor slumber to your eyelids. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hand of the hunter and like a bird from the hand of the fowler." Now, what he's saying there is that if you're in debt, or if you've gone surety, you've got some financial responsibility that you went into foolishly, go and beg for release. Go and beg for forgiveness. Go and beg to have it modified, if you can, with the lender. Now, if your lender is a bank or a credit card company, you know, they don't care anything about you, and they're not going to have any compassion. But they might care about their bottom line, and they might realize that if you file for bankruptcy, they're not going to get much from you, and they might settle for something less. but maybe you're in a position where you can't give them anything at all. In a case like that, I would just, I mean, if I were in that position, thankfully I don't have any debt, and I don't want any, I would simply write to them and say, listen, this is what I have. I don't have any more. I don't have a job. I want to pay you off. But the interest rate you're charging is crazy, and I can't just let this hang. There may be a time, I think, when you have to file for bankruptcy just to get out from under an escalating interest rate that's crazy and unjust. But even if you did file for bankruptcy, in my opinion, you should consider yourself, although not legally bound to repay it, I think bound before God to repay it. At least I would. I think of that verse you mentioned in the Psalms, the wicked man borrows and doesn't repay. I believe that my integrity matters more than anything else in my life. Certainly my integrity matters more than my standard of living does. And so if I have to reduce myself to living in a trailer court and give every penny I can beyond what it takes to feed my family and pay the rent toward a debt, then I would do it. Just because integrity is valuable. And I wouldn't, just from my youth, I've just never been willing to compromise my integrity for anything. And so I would, even if I had to file for bankruptcy to get out from under something I couldn't pay on the terms that they were requiring, I would still consider my conscience toward God was I should still pay this off as I can. I had a father-in-law whom I greatly admire. He was a very wealthy man at one time. He's not now. He gave most of his money away to the poor in Haiti. He was a very wealthy philanthropist. But at one time, he had run a business that was worth a lot, and he had gotten a lot of personal debt, which he could not pay. And he had no choice, I think, but to file for bankruptcy. But after he had filed for bankruptcy and got out from under that debt, he spent, I believe, 12 years working and making payments to those people that could not demand money from him anymore. And he paid off every penny, as I recall. This happened before I knew him, but this is the story as I heard it. And to me, that's just the way a Christian does things. You know, a Christian doesn't look for their legal loopholes. They may have to take them if they have no way out other than that. But even so, if I borrowed money, I'd have to say, you know, it was dumb of me to borrow money. I shouldn't have lived beyond my means. But I'm the one who did it. You know, I'm the one who made these decisions. I'm the one who obligated myself. And to honor God, I'm going to pay off every penny that I owe. And that's what I think a Christian's attitude should be. But that does not necessarily mean that they would never file for bankruptcy. It just means that if they had to do that, that they should still, I believe, make every attempt to for the rest of your life, if necessary, make payments. They may have to be tiny payments, maybe $5 a month, if that's all you can do, but make payments until you pay off what you owe. Because I think a Christian should be watching out for his integrity more than anything else. That's my thought. You may find Christians who disagree with me on that. In fact, you will on many things. Maybe that too. Let's talk to Lydia from Seattle, Washington next. Hi, Lydia. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just curious about the book Apocalypse 2012, if you know anything about that.
I don't. Is it a Christian book?
I don't know. John Claeys is the author.
You know, I don't know the author and I don't know the book, but I know there's a lot of buzz, you know, in the secular world
mm-hmm.
about 2012 being, you know, the end of the world because of the Mayan calendar and other indicators. And the word apocalypse, although it's a biblical word, is often used in secular speech too.
I agree.
You know, and so it may be a secular book. I'm not familiar with the author.
Okay.
And I've not heard of it.
What is your opinion of the Christian Post?
I've never read the Christian Post either.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry to say.
I've crossed that on my computer from time to time. And this gentleman writes a lot of articles regarding his book on the Christian Post website.
Oh, okay. Well, then it is a Christian book, I guess, by a Christian author. I don't know anything about the Christian Post or this author.
Okay.
But I really am turned off by people who set dates.
I am too. The Lord says nobody knows.
Yeah, and by the way, Harold Camping says it's going to happen this Saturday.
That's right. I can hardly wait.
I know.
Okay, thank you for taking the time for me.
All right, ladies. Sorry, I can't help you better.
Thank you.
Bye now. It is perhaps easy to chuckle about Harold Camping's date today, but it's really kind of a tragic thing. I think Christians should be, in a sense, weeping for that man. He's had a ministry for decades with a measure of credibility in the body of Christ. I won't say it was always a high level, but it was a measure of credibility. And we're looking at a man who's basically self-destructing his ministry. He's to me, that's sad. To me, that's a very sad thing. And, this Sunday, when Harold Camping is proven wrong again about his date setting, his credibility is going to be shot. Of course, he's old enough to retire, but it's just too bad. Not just what happens to him, but what could have been. You know, when a man owns that many radio stations, has that much money to spread the gospel, and then just deconstructs himself with this kind of nonsense, it's a terribly sad thing. But others are going to do similar things with the year 2012. Of course, Sun Myung Moon has January 13th, 2013 is going to be the big day. There's all kinds of people making predictions, but those dates come up and they go. And when they come and go, and nothing happens, somehow these people just carry on as if they hadn't said a thing, which is very strange. Larry from Las Vegas, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to make a comment, first of all. I really appreciate the way you treat people, especially the ones that disagree with you. I know you've got several people, a Catholic and perhaps a Buddhist and a Muslim, that are constantly calling you, and I'm sure that they feel like you're their friend the way you treat them.
Well, I hope they are my friend. Thank you. Yeah.
But I thoroughly agree with you on your comment on integrity. My grandfather had a business during the Depression, and his people, the people owed him money, couldn't pay him, and they filed bankruptcy. He worked the rest of his life to pay back the people he owed.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think that's just honorable.
I think that's a Christian way to do it.
And I think Christians have lost sight of the concept of being honorable.
Mm-hmm. Well, but to get to my question, in church Sunday we had several comments made about Allah. The first one, the man made a comment that Osama bin Laden was praying to his God, and the way he said it was as if his God was a God. With a capital G, and I took offense from that. And then a lady standing there took offense from what I said, and she said that that our God and Allah, or the Muslims' God, was Abraham's God, and it's the same God.
Well, that is such a complex question because of the way people use the word God. I mean, even in the Old Testament, Baal and Molech and Chemosh and the gods of the pagans are called gods with a small g,
right.
And they're not real gods at all. And then, of course, for many people today, when they talk about God, what they're talking about is really a composite of their theological opinions. In other words, a concept, not a real God who's out there, but just a concept out there of a deity that they can imagine and that they can describe according to the way they would accept one. But that's not a real God out there either. There's only one real God. Now, the question of whether Allah, among the Muslims, is the real God or not, that has been a very hot, controversial subject, even among Christian missionaries who reach out to Muslims. Some believe that Allah should be seen as the real God, but that the Muslims have misunderstood him and misdefined him, and they need to understand that that he has a son named Jesus, although the Muslims deny it, and so forth. Others would say, no, Allah is like the gods of the heathen in the Old Testament, who were said to be demons. So there are really two opinions about that, and it's very difficult to know what to say, because the word Allah is really just the Arabic word for God. You know, even before Muhammad started the Muslim religion, in the Arabic language, the word for God was Allah. So when Muhammad came along and said, there's only one God, Allah, and, you know, I'm his prophet, you know, he was using a word, not so much a proper name for God, but the word in their language that is the ordinary word for God. So that even the Christians who are Arabic Christians, they use the word Allah when they say God, not because they're affirming anything about the God of Muhammad, but because it's the word in their language that means God. So it gets to be really, really difficult. I think what we can say is that God himself alone knows to what degree any given person who uses the word Allah is speaking about him, and to what degree they're speaking about some demonic imposter. Because, like I say, any Arab who speaks of God will use the word Allah, but do they mean the same thing by that word as Muhammad meant, or that Arabic Christians mean, or Arabic Jews who might speak Arabic? So it's an awkward question. I think the main issue here is that the behavior of many Muslims, we have to say the radical Muslims, the Islamists who are, you know, supporting terrorism and so forth, if that reflects the views of their God, then their God is a demon. I think we could say that much.
Wow.
Because the real God does not believe in wiping out innocent people, to make your point.
Right. That's a good way to put it. The way I understood it, I thought that the Muslims' God was, like you were saying, a God with a small g, like the other gods that were mentioned in the Old Testament.
Uh-huh.
But she was very adamant about it. But she also mentioned that they believe that Jesus was a prophet. And I said, well, you know, if they believe Jesus is a prophet, they also believe that prophets cannot lie.
Yeah.
Jesus said that he was the Son of God, which means he must be, he's either the Son of God or he's not a prophet. They say
yeah.
He's a prophet, he's the Son of God, and they should worship him also.
Well, you make a good point. Of course, the Muslims would say that the records of the life of Jesus that we have in the Gospels have been altered, and that they would say he never really claimed to be the Son of God, but they can't prove that. I mean, certainly there's no evidence at all that the records have been altered from the earliest manuscripts to the present. They're pretty much all, they all say the same thing. You know, it reminds me of a conversation that Ravi Zacharias had with a Muslim when he was, I think, in Jordan. He was speaking at a church in Jordan, if I remember the details correctly. And he was going into a camera store to buy some film. And, of course, it was all these local Arab, you know, Muslim men there. And it was a Jordanian pastor, I think, if I'm not mistaken, who took him to the store. And when the store owner saw him and saw that he was from India, he said, oh, Hindi, you know, you're a Hindu. The Muslims like Hindus. And Ravi Zacharias said, no, I'm actually a Christian. I'm a Christian preacher. I'm preaching in church in this area this week. And the store owner said, oh, you're a Christian. He says, well, what do you think about Muhammad? And Rabbi Zacharias looked around at, you know, there's all these Muslim men, you know, looking at him to see how he'll answer the question, what do you think about Muhammad? And so Rabbi Zacharias said to the pastor next to him, he said, well, you tell him. And the pastor said, he asked you. And so Rabbi Zacharias said this. He says, well, he said, was Jesus a prophet? And the store owner said, yes. Muhammad said Jesus was a prophet. And Zacharias said, well, Rabbi Zacharias said, can a prophet lie? And he said, no. And Rabbi Zacharias says, well, then, if Jesus said he was the only way to God, therefore, if Jesus was right, then Muhammad is wrong. But if Jesus was wrong, then Muhammad is still wrong because he said Jesus was right.
I love Ravi Zacharias. He is an awesome man.
He's pretty sharp.
Yes, I love whenever he gets into a conversation. anybody wants to debate. If anybody wants to debate, he's my man. I want to put him in the front.
Yeah.
he is. But he's like you. He doesn't get mad. He doesn't get upset. He doesn't get rattled. He knows what he believes. And he puts his finger right back into the scriptures, into the Bible, and says, this is where I get my information.
Yeah, I respect him a lot.
Yeah. Okay, Steve.
Okay, Larry.
Thank you so much. That'll give me something to chew on anyway.
Thanks for your call, brother.
Take care. God bless you.
Bye. God bless you. Bye now. Okay, we'll talk next to Jim from Arlington, Washington. Hi, Jim. Welcome.
Hi. I've got a question about insurance. I know there's some Christians that don't believe insurance is right because you're not putting all your faith in God. What do you think about it?
Well, there's insurance for lots of different things. Some things you're required by law to have insurance on, like your car. I think that Christians, I don't think it's even controversial for Christians to have car insurance because they can't legally drive without it. When it comes to life insurance or health insurance, those are different issues, I think. For one thing, health insurance is something you get in part to take care of yourself if you get sick, whereas life insurance is to take care of your survivors if you die. And so a person might say, since we certainly are going to die at some point, that paying into a life insurance policy is simply making an investment in the provision of your survivors, you know. And I don't know that that's not even, as near as I can tell, not even a gamble. I mean, you're going to die someday, so it seems to me if you maintain a life insurance policy, which I don't have. I don't have life insurance or health insurance. I don't have any insurance except on my car. But, I have accidental death insurance for my kids. But I have never had health insurance nor wanted it because I just want to leave my finances, my personal needs, in the hands of God. Now, I don't think that all Christians are called to do the same thing I'm doing. I don't know if you've listened to me enough to know that I've never taken a salary, never charged or anything for anything I do in the ministry because I don't believe the ministry should become a business. And so I'm a volunteer, and I've just always trusted God to provide for me, almost always from entirely unpredictable places, for all my needs. Well, that would include my medical needs. Although I don't necessarily think God will always heal my sicknesses, as some people believe, I believe that medical insurance doesn't in any way guarantee that you won't get sick. It doesn't even guarantee that you'll get cured. Medical insurance doesn't guarantee your health at all. All it guarantees is money. It guarantees that if you need health care, that will be paid for. You know, you might still die. You might, you know, there's no guarantee of health with health insurance. There's just guarantee of money. Well, the way I see it, God has already promised to provide all the money I need for any needs. And health needs are the same as food or housing or clothing needs. So I've never really had any desire for health insurance. But I don't think it's necessarily wrong. But in some ways, I would have an objection to regular health insurance when there's better options. I think, for example, that some of these Christian co-op health plans, what's it called? MediShare is one of them, I think, and there's another one, I think, Samaritan something. There's a number of Christian cooperative health plans that kind of work like insurance, but but they're different because instead of paying premiums to a company that goes toward their bottom line, you send your monthly money to some other Christian family who has a health need. So it's really,
I've heard of that in our church. I talked to a couple of people that do that. They just send $100, $150. I don't know how it's all, who controls it and who regulates it as far as.
Yeah, I've never done it. I don't.
Idea.
Yeah, I don't have one of those services, but if I was going to provide some kind of, health insurance type thing for me and my family, I would definitely go that route because that's really just the body of Christ sharing with the needs of other members of the body of Christ. Whereas when you have a regular insurance plan, of course you're sharing with a bunch of people who aren't Christians, which is okay, I guess. But I mean, I'd rather see my money go into the pockets of needy Christians. So
I've also heard it too that insurance it becomes binding and controlling on what you do and what you can do in your life as well, you know.
So, in what way?
Well, as far as dictating what, you know, I can't bring up an example exactly right now.
Well, I know that some of these Christian health plans that I mentioned, I think they require that you don't smoke or drink or something like that. They have some kind of privilege. I don't know what regular health insurance plans would have. But, you know,
I've got an example. Home insurance. You can get home insurance, but you can't have a swimming pool. You can't have a trampoline, you know, that sort of thing.
I see. Well, yeah, I don't know much about that. I've never actually looked into that. My thought is that the more you can trust God for, the less you'll be disappointed, because those who put their trust in him shall never be ashamed. But the more you trust man for, the more you could be disappointed. But that doesn't mean, I mean, in many ways, we all trust in other people to deliver our food to the market, you know, the truck drivers, and we trust our employers to pay us for the work we do. I mean, it's not like it's wrong to use human interventions where that makes sense to do so. But I myself am just not the right guy to ask about insurance, because I don't really know much about insurance. I've never really been into it. I just really have wanted to trust God for my needs, and he's always provided.
Sure. I think I've got an answer out of you on this.
Okay. Well, I'm not giving you a strong yay or nay on that. That's
no,
basically up to the conscience.
Yeah.
Okay.
You kind of seem to lean towards the other. Towards no insurance, but yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you, Steve.
Okay, Jim. God bless you.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want to say I lean toward no insurance. Like I said, if I were to get some kind of a health plan, I'd probably want to go with one of these Christian ones, just because I'd like to keep the money in the family, you know. But there are people who have very different needs than I have, and I just think everyone should follow their own conscience before God about that. Let's talk to Susie from Cedro Woolley, Washington. Is that the name of the place?
This is Cedro Woolley.
Cedro Woolley. Never heard of it. Welcome.
Oh, well, we're just up about an hour north from Seattle.
Is that right?
Yes. So it's kind of in the area of Mount Vernon, Anacortes.
Okay. I have friends in Mount Vernon. Yeah.
Oh, okay. We're just a little east of there.
Okay.
And more recently, I've heard your program for the first time, a month ago, I guess. And I really do appreciate your interest in studying and being a Berean and examining the scriptures, and that leads to me to a question that I had.
Okay.
You know, about 2 months ago, I think it was when I first started listening, you mentioned something about dispensationalism.
Yeah.
And you said that you had understood that, but you did not go along with that, and I didn't get quite what your reasoning was for that.
Okay. The my theme music has started, which means I don't have very much time, and I wish I could give you a long answer for this. Would it be possible for you to call tomorrow at the beginning of the show, and I could give you a much longer answer than I could possibly hope to do right now?
Oh, sure. That's fine, and I can do that. Now, your first name was Steve or Dave?
My first name is Steve. Steve Gregg. Uh-huh.
Steve. Well, I can do that, and thank you so much for your time.
Okay, Susie, I'm sorry to put you off, because I'd love to answer your question, but I'm going to be cut off the air myself within a few seconds. So if you call tomorrow, we can give an unrushed answer to that. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported, and we depend on listener support to pay the radio stations for the time we use here. If you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. Many free resources to you there, nothing for sale. There is a PayPal link if you want to donate there, too, if you'd like. It's thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. I'm Steve Gregg. Hope you'll join us again tomorrow. We can continue our discussion.